This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharid Abdullah and you are listening to The Breakfast Grill. My guest this morning is Tan Sri Dr. Jameela Mahmood, the Undersecretary General for Partnerships at the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, who is also the founder of Mercy Malaysia. Now, based in Geneva for her role as the Undersecretary General for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society, she is here as one of the judges for the PwC Building Trust Award to recognize and celebrate companies that are making strides to build trust through their communications and interactions with stakeholders. Dr. Jameela, it's an absolute pleasure to have you in the studio today, and thank you so much for making the time to speak to us on The Breakfast Grill.
Thank you so much for having me here. What a pleasure.
You know, we have to start with your experience, the time when you started off humanitarian effort. What were your main motivating factors in setting up Mercy Malaysia?
To be honest, I think I've been deep down a humanitarian since I was a child. I was brought up in a family that was very generous, very benevolent. Even I always tell people that, you know, on May 13th was the first time I actually became a humanitarian, because I was a young child and my father and mother would pack food for me because I was small enough to walk in the monsoon drains and deliver food around the community. I grew up in a school that was a Asunta Secondary School, so very much, you know, charity was part of the culture of the school. And then I became a doctor, and I always wanted to become a doctor because I felt I could contribute to suffering around the world, not just in terms of dealing with patients on a day-to-day basis. Whenever you turn on the television, and we're talking 1990s, you'd never really see an Asian face leading a humanitarian operations. It would always be, you know, a Western face. And, you know, it was a dominance of a Western sort of humanitarian action.
That's right.
And I felt very strongly that, you know, we were a country that was so developed and so successful in so many ways. Why aren't we giving back? I looked around, I wrote to many organizations in Malaysia, but I didn't receive a response. At the time, it was a conflict in Kosovo.
Yeah.
And also it was a time that, I guess, when I was a bit more independent, I completed all my postgraduate studies, I was in private sector, in private practice. I really wanted to do this. Finally, I said, this is the time. And no one responded. So I wrote to Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, and they said, yes, you know, please, let's have an interview and see how you fit in. But it was my husband who actually said, well, if you set something up, I'm sure other Malaysians will want to do good. Because I kept complaining, why are Malaysians standing up and becoming international in this arena? So that was the birth of Mercy Malaysia.
So you started off without any experience of running an NGO. So how difficult was it? Was it all by yourself, or you had several colleagues who had shared similar interests as you do?
Ignorance is bliss. When you sure. don't really know what to expect, you go in and, you know, you have all the passion and all the energy. And of course, you have friends and supporters. You can never be a leader without people who actually follow you, right? I mean, it was such a privilege to have friends. It was really funny setting up Mercy Malaysia in Malaysia. To have a Malaysia in your organization, you need to have seven sort of council members from seven states.
And you didn't know any of that before?
Literally dragging, you know, the anesthetist who was giving me gas that day was from someone from Kedah. You know, my best friend was from Kelantan, one more from Malacca, you know, depending where their ICs were, basically finding seven states and forming an exco and just saying to them, trust me, you know, I'll deal with everything, but just trust me. And then I guess the rest is history. You know, once you set something up, then you, by word of mouth, people say, hey, hang on, I want to do this. It was really nice because there were many doctors who really wanted to be, you know, involved in this, but didn't have a platform before.
So now is the 20th anniversary of Mercy
yes.
Malaysia, and the organization has grown leaps and bounds, especially its involvement with many of the humanitarian effort. But looking back and looking at Mercy Malaysia now, are you satisfied with how the organization has evolved since it was founded?
Look, I started Mercy Malaysia because I wanted to plant a seed. I wanted it to grow into a tree that many people could take shade under, people could own. It was never about me, right? It was about really building a world-class organization for our country. That's why I decided to leave after 10 years because, you know, you can be a founder, you can be a mover, you can be a shaker, you can get the things running. But you know, all good leaders must know when to step down. I made an announcement very early and, you know, did some succession sort of training and planning and then, you know, left it. And to be honest, right now, I don't really have a role. I'm not on the board. I'm not on the trustees. You know, it was deliberate that, you know, the Constitution did not, I guess, allow for the founder to play a significant role. So I know it as much as you do from looking at websites and all that. I think that the most important thing I invested in was, you know, building a really strong culture and a strong team when I was there. I was very fortunate to have people who left the private sector, who left, you know, their jobs to join us. And we invested heavily and we had a lot of help from the private sector in looking at our corporate governance, sustainability, risk management, so on and so forth. Once you have an organization that is built to survive, then hopefully the successor takes it on and makes it even stronger through other innovations that have to happen in organizations.
So you laid out the foundation and planted the seed. I was looking at the annual report of Mercy Malaysia. I took an interest to compare the difference between the time you helmed Mercy Malaysia and how it is run today. For an example, there was strong emphasis on education. With regards to finances, you are more prudent, where expenditure was around 55% of the total donations collected in comparison to around 87% 2 years ago. Now, based on this information, what are your thoughts on this trend and direction that Mercy Malaysia is taking right now?
I have not seen the annual report, so I really can't comment. Look, when we started Mercy Malaysia, it was very much a volunteer-based organization, right? I mean, when we started off, volunteers had to pay for their own airfare to go and do work in war zones. You know, it was, and if they couldn't afford, they paid installments, or we got other people to pay. But now, Mercy Malaysia is a professional organization. I would be very surprised if it's more than, if that's how high the cost is. Maybe it's the way it's reported. I'm not sure about this, so I can't really comment. But it's a professionally run organization now. We have professional sort of technical teams. It's very well known in the region for reconstruction, rehabilitation, and doing, you know, disaster risk reduction work and so on and so forth. So I think that, you know, if there is, you know, a representation in the annual report that is worrying, I think, you know, this is good to highlight. And I certainly hope there are people listening out there from Mercy Malaysia who will look into this and that the leadership will address it because, you know, there are certain accountability standards. And this is something that I worked on when I was a leader, that we took our organization through humanitarian accountability certification. And we were the third organization in the world to be certified for accountability. So I think that culture should still be there, right? And so I would be very surprised if it was that high. I think that the difficulty, and I'll be very honest here, one of the things I did manage to do when I was at Mercy Malaysia was actually secure philanthropy to actually cover operating costs. Because I said to my donors, I do not want to have to worry every day about how I'm going to pay the salaries of my staff.
So hence the buffer of close to 45%.
Yeah. So you know, if I'm going to collect donations from the public, it has to go to people in need. And because of that, you know, there were enough donors that trusted me enough to say, okay, fine, we'll give you a certain amount of money that at least covers, you know, your rental of your space. And we got a lot of pro bono in those days, you know, paying some of your staff salaries and so forth, so that every contribution we got, you know, almost all of it would go to people affected by crisis. So the call I will make today to donors is that you cannot expect to run a professional organization without having core funding for its operations. I worked in the UN before. I now work in the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Core funding is critical for us because it does cover the overheads.
Okay, speaking about funding, and I think the reason why I raised it up is more on the issue of sustainability of NGOs, right? Yep. And I'm taking a quote here from an X-Star Media Group CEO, Dato' Sri Wong Chun Wai, who was one of the panelists in KAI Malaysia 2018. Mm-hmm. And he highlighted the sustainability of mm-hmm. NGOs. NGO, and he said that it will be a tough year for non-profit NGOs attempting to garner contribution, especially when you operate as our national growth is projected to be between 4 and 5%. Hmm. And this year, that is the projection between 4 to 4.6%. Now, do you agree with his opinion that there is a tie down between contribution as well as the state of the economy?
Yes. Well, yes and no. I think that generally, we don't have the evidence in Malaysia of how much our public spends in philanthropy. If, for example, if you go to Australia and other countries, you can actually see, say, 1 in 8 citizens of Australia are regular donors to a charity. We don't have that data here, and I think it's important to have that. The other thing is our public is very reactive in their funding. Whenever they see a tsunami, an earthquake, you have the outpouring, but in between there's none. So there are some very, very good NGOs in Malaysia doing extremely important work who don't really get the attention or the funding that's required. I think what we need is really a good strategy for civil society, which is something I've been, you know, sort of trying to advocate for a long time, where you actually look at civil society being a very important contributor to your economy, because there are many things that civil society organizations do that actually support, you know, some of the government endeavors or private endeavors to actually meet the needs of people, right? I work with the International Federation. We have the Malaysian Red Crescent, who's a member of our federation, and the Red Cross and Red Crescent societies are not NGOs. They're auxiliary organizations to government, which means that when the government signs and ratifies the Geneva Convention, you can form a national society. Now, auxiliary means where there are gaps, auxiliary organizations can fill that gap or help to fill that gap, which means you have to think strategically about how these people get sustainable funding. Mm-hmm. I think the model of just, expecting donations, one-off donations, is not sustainable. In most successful NGOs, the biggest growing funding market is actually individual giving. So I used to be a regular donor to Medicine Sans Frontier, mainly because I wanted to receive the newsletters and learn about what the organization was doing. So I think NGOs in Malaysia need to learn how to become good fundraisers. It's a skill. Individual giving is also about social entrepreneurship. How can you actually, develop your NGOs also to be social entrepreneurs? The services you provided, the consultancy you might be able to give. So you've got to shift that funding model. But for humanitarian organizations, unfortunately, the majority of the funding is very emotive.
So I guess taking into consideration the change of technology scene as well, there's a lot of enablers out there.
Absolutely.
That could, as you mentioned, that could probably facilitate what you have just mentioned earlier. But before that, joining us on The Breakfast Grill this morning is Tan Sri Dr. Jamila Mahmud, the Undersecretary General for Partnership at the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Next, we'll continue our conversation on what motivated her to take on the life as a humanitarian after these short messages. So stay with us on BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
You've tuned in to BFM 89.9. On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Tan Sri Dr. Jamila Mahmud, the Undersecretary General for Partnerships at the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Dr. Jamila, earlier we spoke about the issue of sustainability amongst NGOs and how the sector has a discipline on its own. Now, one of the important components of NGOs is the workforce. Now, I'm referring to Mercy Malaysia as an example. In terms of the numbers, back in 1999, you started off with about 7,000 volunteers as president. But now, today, if we look at the numbers here, it has dropped to about 2,600. What are the reasons, do you think, attributed to this drop in volunteer numbers?
Okay, it isn't attributable only to Mercy Malaysia. Globally, we are facing a drop in the number of volunteers who are registering as formal volunteers. It doesn't mean that they're not volunteers, but they may not formally register as volunteers. I mentioned I work with the International Federation. Globally, we have right now about 13.7 million volunteers. And that, has dropped from about 17 million. So you're talking about a significant drop. Is it because people don't want to work with the Red Cross and Red Crescent anymore? It's not that. It's basically because we now live in a world where young people are much more interested in self-organized groups. So organizations need to evolve. They need to be attractive to volunteers. So what we're doing now now is employing very interesting techniques, and we're bringing back the numbers in a big way. So similarly, I think with Mercy Malaysia, when we started, you know, it was a novel idea. Mercy Malaysia was almost like a pioneer in its in this sector in Malaysia that was really, you know, visible internationally and so forth. I think along the way, as I mentioned, we become much more professional. Even during my tenure, you know, when we had a technical team, we had a psychosocial team. So we needed expertise to actually go out there. Some were volunteers, but some we realized we had to hire, you know, engineers and so forth to be able to do the work. So quality is always much more important than quantity. But in any crisis, the number of volunteers can shoot up very quickly without them being formally registered. So I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay, Dr. Jamila, right now, as you mentioned, you are part of the IFRC. Yeah. You are now Under Secretary General of IFRC, and you've been appointed since 2016.
Yeah.
Could you share with us, what is your role and mandate as the Undersecretary?
Sure. Well, the IFRC is the largest and oldest humanitarian organization in the world. We're a membership organization. So if you like, we're kind of like the FIFA to the football associations. We are the federation to the national societies around the world, whether it's Singapore Red Cross, you know, Malaysian Red Crescent and so forth. Our membership is in 191 countries. So we have 191 national societies around the world. We have 165,000 branches around the world and about 13.7 million volunteers. Mm. So we're everywhere for everyone. Because we are rooted locally in national societies, the first responders are often local and national. So this is where the national societies become important. Our role as a federation, as a membership organization, obviously is around governance, is around providing policies and guidance, strategies. So my particular day job is, you know, I'm Under Secretary General of Partnerships. We have the Secretary General, we have three Under Secretary Generals. I'm one of them, and I have a huge, very wide portfolio from policy, strategy, knowledge, innovation, global communications, partnership, resource development, and then I look after the UN and New York office. So in all the thinking around planning, strategy, financing, you know, resource mobilization, global comms is under my purview. But of course, you know, we share the responsibility across the house.
Was it a natural transition for you to get into this job in comparison to your experience before?
You know, I am a huge believer in localization. I really believe that local action is best. And I really wanted to experience an organization that was the, you know, the DNA of an organization that was about localization. And this is the only organization in the world is actually the Red Cross and Red Crescent. Everywhere you go in the world where there is a Red Cross or Red Crescent, they are the local actors. They're in communities. So being in the Federation allows me the best of both worlds. I'm in the international side, meaning I have to handle international policy and dialogue and strategies, but I also get to experience firsthand, you know, things that people are doing. If I can give you one story too, that really, really woke me up. I was in Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, you know, looking at the Rohingya crisis. And one morning I woke up and I saw a troop of, you know, Bangladeshi volunteers, Red Crescent volunteers carrying, you know, things on their shoulders. And I asked, what are they doing? They're walking around the ridges. And they were collecting waste from all the camps to be brought to the treatment center. Now, that's probably one of the most undignified things to do. These are volunteers, 150 volunteers collecting fecal material and stuff to be treated in a waste management plan so that we would prevent the spread of disease. We would be, you know, ensuring the health of people living in these situations, and to do it with so much pride. And I think that made me so convinced that, you know, this was probably one of the best things I decided in my life to really experience this. You know, I'm a prolific learner. I'm curious. I think that, you know, this job has allowed me the ability to really look from the international perspective as well as a very, very local, you know, branch perspective from Cox's Bazar or in, you know, in Africa and so forth.
You know, it sounds like your perspective is valuable to many. So it brings me to ask you that question. Do you have an ambition to someday lead IFRC as the Secretary General?
Actually, I never think that far, okay? For me, I do whatever job I'm in, I'd like to do it the best that I can. And when I feel that, you know, I'm worn out and it's time to go, I leave. I tell you what I've been thinking a lot about. You know, there are days when I go to bed at night and I lie and I reflect on my day and I ask myself, which Malaysian is going to replace me? And that's the thing that keeps me awake, right? How many Malaysians are willing to do what I do? And it's such a blessing to be able to do what I'm doing. And the experience I've gained is just, you know, life-changing. And I think, you know, if I am going to do something, the next natural thing would be looking at leadership development. And I would like to, you know, really harness Malaysian women and Malaysian young people to take on the challenge of this job. It's not a do-gooder job. This is a serious job. Mm. You know, my organization has a budget of $500 million US, and globally the Red Cross and Red Crescent is a $40 billion movement. So, you know, it's larger than some corporations. So it's about good governance. It's about good management. It's about accountability. It's about good communications. So it's a fantastic experience. I think we need more Malaysians and Asians out there. We have a very different perspective. We come from a very different culture. And the diversity that we bring into the dialogue is just amazing.
Okay. I mean, this is not something that you have just said on radio. Before, you have said that we Malaysian, we should be punching above our weight.
Absolutely.
So, you know, for those who would like a perspective from you now, what are some of the fundamental qualities that you think one would need to be leading at this level?
Well, the first thing is, when you ask yourselves, what do humanitarian organizations sell? What is our commodity? It's trust. Right? So for you to be able to lead, number one, you have to have real conviction that what you're doing is important. You have to be, you know, someone who believes that, you know, integrity and honesty and accountability is key. You need to build trust, because whatever you say you need to do, whatever you do, you know, then you tell the world what you're doing, and you shouldn't be shy about it, because only then you can educate, you know, people and attract others to the job. But I think most of all, it's about, you know, passion, professionalism. It's extremely important. And always know that there are times, I will tell you now, that you can burn out as a humanitarian. That's why, you know, between 2011 to 2014, I took a break, and I was in King's College London. I was doing humanitarian futures, and I was doing research as well at the same time, because it really can wear you down. You know, when you see so much suffering head on, there are times you need to take a break. So I would encourage any young person listening out there, or even any older person listening out there, you know, if this is where your passion is, you know, there are many channels to get into this. I never imagined when I started school that I would be where I am today. You know, I'm a doctor, I'm a gynecologist, but I have no regrets.
Okay, I think we are running out of time, and I do have one last question before we end this grill today. Now, you have a scar as a reminder, you know, of a bullet suffered when you were in Iraq. Does it have a special significance for you now, and as far as your legacy is concerned?
You know, it reminds me of how vulnerable we are as humanitarians. It reminds me that I have a huge responsibility. You know, the scar that I have is not because of anything that is heroic, but the fact that we had to do a job and we were caught in a situation where, you know, some people lost their lives. And I always say that, you know, it should be a painful reminder to me that, you know, my job is not done, that the security of our teams and the security of ourselves, our own personal security, is critical. But at the end of the day, when you do everything and you try to put in the systems in place and things just happen, you have to accept that the humanitarian sector is now no longer sacrosanct. This is the world we live in today.
Dr. Jamila, thank you so much for speaking to us on The Breakfast Grill.
Thank you.
So I've been speaking to Tan Sri Dr. Jamila Mahmood, the Undersecretary General for Partnership at the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. You have been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Sharif Abdullah for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Now with wider 4G LTE reach. Baru la best.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.